Hare Krishna. In the Vaishnava society, great personalities are remembered for many reasons, and there are certain occasions on which these remembrances intensify, and devotees particularly focus their hearing and chanting and remembering about those acharyas. One is, of course, the date of their appearance in this world. There may be other occasions where some very extraordinary event happened in the life of that devotee. And finally, there is the date of disappearance of that acharya from this world, from the external plane. On the spiritual plane, of course, the acharya continues to exist in all his devotional glory. Nevertheless, since he has disappeared from mundane vision, that date is very important for his followers who are still here in this world. Even though the appearance day of the acharyas is also celebrated, it is interestingly the disappearance day that is celebrated or followed, observed rather, with greater, shall we say, festivity in one sense. And the word festivity is a little troublesome to use here, because it is a mixed occasion of sadness and joy. The cause for sadness is, of course, very clear, that the acharya is no longer in our physical presence. We have lost his physical association, and therefore that is a source of great pain and sorrow for all the Vaishnavas. As we have seen from the song that we just sung, the sorrow that follows the physical departure of a great Vaishnava is very, very difficult to bear for those who are true Vaishnavas. Of course, unless one loves these personalities, one cannot feel separation. Separation arises only when there is deep love. The deeper the love, the deeper the sense of separation, and the deeper the sense of grief that one experiences on losing their association. So, at least we follow in the footsteps of the great acharyas and understand what Vaishnava culture is, what Vaishnava etiquette is, and what Vaishnava mindset and attitude is, what Vaishnava heart is. So therefore, when we come to the society of devotees, we are trained to actually observe certain ceremonies in certain ways, because these are very conducive for the development of our Krishna consciousness. We may or may not have the kind of love and the kind of separation that Narottam Das Thakur has sung about in that song. However, by participating in such ceremonies in a non-duplicitous manner with faith and with sincerity, one day we will also be able to attain a similar kind of sentiment that is genuine, deep, and spiritual. So, on the occasion of the departure from this world of the great acharyas, there is this overwhelming feeling of separation and sadness. Because as Ramananda Rai also has spoken to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that there is no greater sorrow in this world than not having the association of devotees. However, because the great acharya or the great devotee has gone back to the pastimes of the Lord, resumed active participation in the transcendental pastimes of the Lord in Goloka Vrindavan. So in that sense, it's a source of happiness too. That devotee doesn't have to be here in the material world going through the anxieties of trying to deliver the conditioned souls, a task which is enormously difficult and fraught with so many anxieties and troubles. Of course, great acharyas like Srila Bhaktivinod Thakur give us another understanding of how these anxieties have to be understood and experienced. Srila Bhaktivinod Thakur has prayed to the Lord that, "My dear Lord, the anxieties that I experience in your service are actually my devotional ecstasies." So in a sense, the great devotees like Srila Bhaktivinod Thakur are always absorbed in transcendental bliss, even in their earthly sojourn. They remain fixed always on the task for which they have come here, which is to deliver many, many conditioned souls by bringing them back to the lotus feet of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So in any case, such occasions are occasions of mixed sorrow and happiness. Another point I would like to make before we begin discussing Srila Bhaktivinod Thakur in particular is how necessary it is for us to hear and chant about these great devotees. On the absolute plane, there is no difference between Krishna and his paraphernalia, which means his abode, his associates, and so on. And therefore, when we glorify Krishna, it means we also have to glorify his paraphernalia, his associates, his abode, and so on. So glorification of Krishna not just includes glorification of his associates, but it necessitates the glorification of his associates. Without the glorification of Krishna's associates, glorification of Krishna is incomplete. For the simple reason that Krishna personally feels himself incomplete without the association of his own devotees. As Prabhupada said one time, "What is a king without a kingdom or a king without subjects?" Similarly, what is a Supreme Lord who is Rasaraj, the king of one who experiences divine mellows, without his devotees with whom he can exchange such divine mellows? So the glorification of Krishna's great devotees is an integral part of Krishna consciousness. It is as useful, if not more, than glorification of Krishna. It actually pleases Krishna more when we glorify his pure devotees. After all, it is only through devotees like this, like Bhaktivinod Thakur, for example, that we begin to understand or have some glimpse into the transcendental realm. Otherwise, this material world, which is enveloped in gross darkness of ignorance, is very difficult to penetrate and fathom. So such acharyas come into this world and with the torchlight of their divine knowledge and devotion expose us to a universe of which we have no understanding. They give us the greatest gift that is ever possible for anyone to gift anybody else, and that is pure Krishna consciousness, eventually leading to eternal residence in the lotus feet of the Lord in the midst of his pastimes in Goloka Vrindavan. It is also very nourishing to our devotional kripa to hear about these acharyas. It is very inspirational. Even though they are transcendental personalities, they have appeared in apparently flesh and blood. They also went through the difficulties that any conditioned soul has to go through they were born, they appear to have gone through the motions of life, so to speak. As far as Bhakti Vinod Thakur was concerned, he was a householder, he had 10 children, he had a job, a very responsible job. We'll talk more about that later. But in the midst of all this, he set such a blazing trail as far as devotional service goes. And when we hear about this, then we become inspired in our Krishna consciousness. It's one thing to hear about devotees in Krishna Leela who may have been cowherd boys or the gopis and so on. It seems such a distant, idyllic kind of setting, almost utopian. But where we have these acharyas and devotees who lived in recent times, then it's something that we can relate to more easily. And then when we go through our difficulties in life, when we can remember, well, Bhaktivinod Thakur had his job too. He had such a difficult job to do. He also had a big family. And nevertheless, he was so focused on his Krishna consciousness. So it gives us an inspiration. Another reason for us to hear about these great acharyas is that it makes us understand the value of what we have got. It makes us realize the heritage that we have inherited, the devotional, spiritual heritage that we have received. And therefore today, I would like to focus more on a historical perspective within which we can place Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's contributions. Since we have another 2 days, I will reserve some of the pastimes for the next 2 days. Today I'd like to talk more about Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur in relation to the Sampradaya in which he appeared and in which we have all been fortunate enough to also connect ourselves with. So when we understand these great acharyas in our line, we understand our line, our Sampradaya better. And then we understand what the Sampradaya stands for. We have heard this word Sampradaya often. What does it really mean? I will not get into too many technicalities of the etymology of the term Sampradaya, but just a brief mention is in order. The word Prada, Sampradaya is actually a verb. Prada means to give. And Sam means completely. Like we have kirtan and we have samkirtan. So samkirtan means the perfect kirtan, the complete kirtan, that which is done in the company of loving devotees. So the prefix sam indicates utter, complete, perfect. So prada means to give. So samprada means to give completely. The noun is sampradana, which means a gift or something that is imparted or transmitted. So the purport of the term sampradaya therefore is that within which something that is very precious, very valuable is given utterly, completely and perfectly in the sense that the divine wisdom is taught and gifted actually through this particular body or this system. So a sampradaya is a tradition or a religious system within which divine transcendental knowledge, philosophy and practices are taught. Every sampradaya is characterized by certain unique beliefs, practices, attitudes, philosophies, and so on. And generally, the knowledge within these sampradayas is transmitted from generation to generation through what we call the parampara, the guru-shishya parampara, the disciplic succession. In this way, the knowledge or the wisdom traditions of that sampradaya are perpetuated. and moved on from generation to generation. And the purpose of the parampara is to somehow maintain that. And from time to time, we find that bona fide sampradayas have great personalities, great acharyas who appear. Of course, there is always an unbroken, continuous line of spiritual preceptors. But most often we find that there are many sampradayas in which some preceptors may not stand out so much. They are not so prominent. And there are some who are exceptional for various reasons, and they become more prominent by dint of their qualifications. And it is these prominent acharyas who are most remembered. Indeed, that particular sampradaya may be identified or remembered by the names of those acharyas. So there are Vaishnava sampradayas and there are non-Vaishnava sampradayas. The non-Vaishnava sampradayas we don't consider as bona fide. Although from the Vedic point of view, they follow certain rules and regulations that the Vaishnava sampradayas follow too. But the Vaishnava sampradayas are characterized by, number one, a very direct connection with Krishna. And the sampradaya begins with a very close associate of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has received that knowledge from the Supreme Lord Himself. And then the line continues on, and a certain prominent personality further down the line somehow becomes the one who is most prominent. So in the four Vaishnava Acharya sampradayas, as we know, there is one that starts from the four Kumaras, and that is the Kumara Sampradaya, the prominent Acharya being Nimbarka Acharya. So he is that one Acharya who was most prominent after the four Kumaras. Then we have the Rudra Sampradaya, or Lord Shiva. He is a great Vaishnava. And in his Sampradaya we have Vishnu Swami, who is the most prominent Acharya, who came further down. Then we have the Sri Sampradaya of Goddess Lakshmi, the eternal consort of Lord Vishnu. And in her Sampradaya, we have Ramanuja Acharya, who became the most prominent Acharya, so much so that the Sampradaya is named after him. So we say Ramanuja Sampradaya, Nimbarka Sampradaya, Vishnu Swami Sampradaya, and so on. And finally, there is the Brahma Sampradaya, the Sampradaya inaugurated by Lord Brahma, the creator of this world and the great Vaishnava. And in his line, the most prominent one is Madhvacharya. So it is called the Madhva Brahma Sampradaya. It also happens that sometimes there are offshoots of these sampradayas, or there are certain other sampradayas which are linked to these main sampradayas. Like, for example, the Ramanandi sampradaya is linked to the Ramanuja sampradaya, because there are some distinctions there. Similarly, we have the Gaudiya sampradaya to which we belong. So we have the Gaudiya, Madhva, Brahma sampradaya. The Gaudiya sampradaya is characterized by the fact that we are all followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. By the way, I'm sorry, can I have the copy of a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, please, if someone can give me an English copy? So, the sampradaya that we are in is the Brahma Madhva sampradaya. Thank you. And specifically, it is the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya sampradaya. In a sense, the Gaudiya Sampradaya is like a fifth Sampradaya. But we link ourselves up to the Madhva Sampradaya. So it's very useful and pertinent to trace out what our Sampradaya is like. And then in the context of that, try to see the role of Srila Bhaktivinod Thakur. And why we consider him so important. At the end of his introduction to the Bhagavad Gita as it is, Srila Prabhupada mentions our sampradaya, the parampara. We must distinguish between the sampradaya and the parampara. Within a sampradaya, you can have many paramparas. You can have many disciplic successions. Because after all, a preceptor may have many followers, and each of them may themselves have many disciples, and in this way it branches out. Even though there are many disciplic successions or paramparas within a sampradaya, essentially they are all faithful to the teachings of that sampradaya. There may be minor differences in how that knowledge or those teachings are practiced and presented in the world. For example, today in ISKCON and also in the Gaudiya Mutts, there are some slight differences in the way we practice and the way we present things, although essentially the teachings are the same. For example, we have a certain way in which we do the morning program, a certain songs we chant, a certain procedure we follow. But that is not exactly the way it happens in the Gaudiya Mutts. There it's a little different. They have a different kind of morning program. Similarly, Srila Prabhupada's manner of presentation of Krishna consciousness was slightly different from what some others may have done. Of course, nowadays, as movements spread and become global, everybody feels the necessity to follow in Srila Prabhupada's footsteps and to adopt the kind of means that he did, using modern technology, traveling all over the world, presenting things in a certain way, and so on. So in any case, our particular parampara within the sampradaya has been outlined by Srila Prabhupada. Beginning with Lord Krishna, and then going on to, of course, Brahma is our sampradaya, the founder of our sampradaya. Then there is Narad Muni, there's Vyasadev, there's Madhvacharya. And after Madhvacharya, there is a series of sannyasis. And after that, we have Vyasatirtha and then Lakshmipati. Lakshmipati Tirtha. After Lakshmipati Tirtha was when Madhavendra Puri came in. So actually speaking, the Gaudiya Sampradaya begins with Madhavendra Puri, even though Madhavendra Puri predates Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Madhavendra Puri's disciple Ishwarapuri, Ishwarapuri's disciple was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So even though we say that the Gaudiya Sampradaya are followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the sampradaya actually begins with Madhavendra Puri, according to the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So he was the root, and Mahaprabhu was the trunk, so to speak. So from Madhavendra Puri starts a certain pattern, or a certain way of devotion that wasn't found in the Madhvas. The ecstatic love for the Supreme Lord, and especially that ecstatic love in the mood of the residents of Vrindavan, that wasn't found so much in the Madhva Sampradaya. Now in the list that Srila Prabhupada has outlined here, we will see it is a combination of Diksha and Shiksha lines. When we talk of disciplic successions, we talk of transmission of the teachings from generation to generation. One is connected to a particular sampradaya through the means of diksha, principally. But what we have seen in our parampara is that the connection can also be extremely strong and bona fide if it is a shiksha connection. Shiksha means that we learn by teaching, even though there may not be a formal diksha or an initiation connection, but there is a connection where a devotee submits himself to learn these teachings from an acharya in that sampradaya and surrenders to him and accepts those teachings wholeheartedly. So whether it is by a Diksha connection or by a Shiksha connection, both are considered bona fide connections to the Sampradaya. So in our Sampradaya, we will find a combination of the two. Let's, for example, go through this list a little bit after Madhavendra Puri. After Madhavendra Puri, we have Ishwar Puri. But there were other devotees who were disciples of Madhavendra Puri. There was Advaita Acharya. And it is also considered that Nityananda Prabhu took initiation from Madhavendra Puri. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada here in brackets, after Ishwar Puri, writes Nityananda and Advaita. Now, Ishwar Puri's direct Diksha disciple was Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Now, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not initiate, as far as recorded understanding goes, Sri Rupa Goswami and Sri Sanatana Goswami. Actually, it is not so clear who were the Diksha gurus of Rupa and Sanatana Goswamis. There is some difference of opinion amongst Vaishnava scholars on this point, so we will not enter into that territory. Suffice it to say that even if they did not formally accept initiation from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Shiksha connection was extremely strong. We know that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructed Rupa Goswami for 10 days in Prayag, modern-day Allahabad, at the famous Dashashvamedha Ghat. He also instructed Sanatana Goswami personally for a period of 2 months in Varanasi. So the connection of Rupa and Sanatana Goswami to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is very, very strong. Therefore, after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we find Rupa. Now, Rupa Goswami is considered the Sampradaya Acharya as far as the Gaudiya Sampradaya is concerned. Even though Madhvacharya is the Sampradaya Acharya for the entire Madhva, the Brahma Sampradaya. And why is Rupa Goswami considered so important? And we'll connect this up to Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So you might wonder why I'm giving such an extended background to the whole thing. But there's a reason for it. So we can actually appreciate Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's position even better. Srila Rupa Goswami is actually in his eternal identity in Goloka Vrindavan, Rupa Manjari. It is mentioned in the Gauda Ganodesha Deepika that the topmost servant or devotee of Krishna is Srimati Radharani. The topmost assistant of Srimati Radharani is Lalita Sakhi. The topmost assistant of Lalita Sakhi is Rupa Manjari, who has appeared in God Leela as Rupa Goswami. Therefore, even though Sanatana Goswami was his elder brother and like a guru to him, we are actually known as Rupanugas and not so much as Sanatana Anugas. Anuga means a follower. Because our acharyas have been in that mood of serving Krishna through Srimati Radharani and her followers. And later I'll come to this point, but Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has this very direct connection to Rupa Goswami. But we'll come to that in a moment. Coming to Ishwar Puri, after that to Rupa Goswami, alongside him Srila Prabhupada mentions Swarup and Sanatan. Swarup because he was, even though initiated elsewhere, but he accepted complete shelter at Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's lotus feet and was one of his most intimate associates in Jagannath Puri. Rupa Goswami is considered the Diksha Guru of Raghunath Das Goswami and also of Jiva Goswami. Actually, Raghunath Das Goswami was initiated by Yadunandan Acharya. I beg your pardon. That's also mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and Jiva Goswami was initiated by Rupa Goswami. So here, therefore, after Rupa, we have Raghunath as well as Jiva. That's what Prabhupada mentions here. And then we have, from Raghunath Das Goswami, we have Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, who became his disciple. Now, after Krishna Das Goswami, there is Narottam Das in the parampara. But Narottam Das Thakur did not accept Diksha from from Krishna Das Kaviraj. He took initiation from Lokanath Goswami, who was a direct follower of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So we see that there is a Shiksha link here. There isn't a Diksha link between Narottam and Krishna Das. But these are two consecutive names in the parampara as given by Srila Prabhupada. Which means that when the acharyas list out the parampara like this, they basically talk about the predominant or the prominent acharyas in the line. All of them did take Diksha from some other exalted personality, but in case that exalted personality that didn't somehow become a very prominent person in that acharya's life and he had a Shiksha connection that was stronger, then that Shiksha connection is emphasized in the parampara. And then from Krishna Das there is Narottam, and from Narottam there is Vishwanath. But Vishwanath also was not connected by Diksha to Narottam Das Thakur. He was connected by Shiksha. Vishwanath's connection is, his guru was Radha Raman Chakravarti, whose guru was Krishna Charan Chakravarti, whose guru was Ganga Narayan Chakravarti, and then whose guru was Narottam Das Thakur. So there's several gurus in between whose names have not been mentioned here. They were Diksha, that was a Diksha line. But then the connection of Shiksha was very strong. So right after Narottam, we have Vishwanath's name coming in there. And then after Vishwanath, we have here Baladev in brackets and Jagannath. Although Baladev did not take Diksha from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Baladev took Diksha from, I believe, Madhusudan Das. No, that was Uddhav Das and then Madhusudan Das, I think. Oh, that was Gaur Kishore. Anyway, so Baladev's connection is not to Vishwanath so much, but it is elsewhere. But he took primary Shiksha from Vishwanath, and therefore the name is here. Similarly, it was Jagannath Das Babaji who took Diksha from Madhusudan Das Babaji, who took Diksha from Uddhav Das, who took Diksha from another Uddhav Das. And in this way, the Diksha and Shiksha lines, they vary significantly. But what Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur has done is to emphasize the Shiksha lines very predominantly. So then we come to Bhakti Vinod Thakur. Bhakti Vinod Thakur also did not take initiation from Jagannathas Babaji. Although in our parampara, even on the altar, you see that after Bhakti Vinod is Jagannath Das Babaji. His initiating guru was Bipin Bihari Goswami. But he took a lot of Shiksha and a lot of inspiration from Jagannath Das Babaji. And therefore the connection that we have is after Jagannath, it is straight Bhakti Vinod. We don't find Bipin Bihari Goswami's name here in the parampara. So Bhakti Vinod Thakur therefore comes in this line. His connection to our sampradaya is like this. And now coming back to what I was mentioning earlier about his connection to Rupa Goswami. Rupa Goswami is Rupa Manjari, who is the assistant of Lalita Devi, who is the assistant of Radharani, who is the foremost devotee of Krishna. And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur himself has, in the Gita Mala, in a song called the Siddhi Lalasa, revealed his own eternal identity in Goloka Vrindavan. He says, Varane Tarit Vasataravali Kamala Manjari Nama Sharabara Varsha Vayas Satatam Svananda Sukhata Kunja. He says, talking about his eternal form as a maidservant, as a gopi, as a manjari actually. Manjaris are the assistants of the gopis. He says, Varane Tarit, that my complexion is like lightning.
golden, something like Srimati Radharani's complexion, golden. Vasataravali, my clothing is like a dark night which has many, many stars, a starlit night. So her clothing is like that. Kamala Manjari, Nama, and my name is Kamala Manjari. Elsewhere he mentions that Kamala Manjari is the foremost assistant of Lalita Sakhi, of Rupa Manjari. So that's the connection. Kamala Manjari, Rupa Manjari, Lalita Sakhi, Radharani and Krishna. So because Kamala Manjari is the foremost assistant of Rupa Manjari, therefore Bhaktivinoda Thakur is especially important to us. Shara Baro Varsha Vayas Satatam. I am eternally 12 and a half years old. Shara Baro means 12 and a half. So she is eternally, the Manjaris are slightly younger than the Sakhis, the Gopis, who may be 2 or 3 years older than them. So he's eternally, he says, 12 and a half years old, living in Goloka Vrindavan. And which part of Goloka Vrindavan? Svananda Sukhada Kunja. That's the name of the place, the particular bower in Goloka Vrindavan in which Kamala Manjari lives. So we can now see the connection in the Sampradaya. And this is Bhaktivinoda Thakur's place from this point of view, from the point of view of eternal identity. So in the sense that Rupa Goswami is so important to our Sampradaya, therefore Bhaktivinoda Thakur is also very, very important for us as being the foremost follower of Sri Rupa Goswami. Therefore here it says, Gaura Shakti Swarupaya Rupanoga Varayate. In his Pranam Mantra, he is the transcendental energy, personification of the transcendental energy of Gauranga Mahaprabhu, and he is the best of the followers of Rupa Goswami. Because in his eternal identity as Kamala Manjari, she is the best follower of Rupa Manjari, Rupa Goswami. So we are so blessed to come in a parampara of exalted souls like this, who are eternal associates of Radha and Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan. So these acharyas are not ordinary personalities. They have been sent here, they have been dispatched specifically for the task which is very difficult in Kali Yuga of delivering conditioned souls. So most of our acharyas we see have some such eternal identity, and they are all exalted souls who sometimes, somehow or the other, revealed their roles in Goloka Vrindavan. These acharyas perform extraordinary activities because they have been empowered by the Lord. Generally, one could understand their contributions in three ways. One is that they transmit the teachings of the Sampradaya. Second, they propagate the teachings of the Sampradaya. And the third, that they protect the teachings of the Sampradaya. To transmit the teachings of the Sampradaya means that they actually initiate disciples, or they instruct, even if they don't give diksha, but they give shiksha, and they ensure that the parampara is perpetuated, that it continues, the disciplic succession goes on. The second is they propagate. By propagate, I mean they preach extensively, widely, by various means, sometimes very innovative means as well. They may extensively lecture, they may write books. So they propagate it so that the Sampradaya gains credibility and respectability in the eyes of the world at large. And the third thing, they protect the Sampradaya's teachings. Of course, by transmitting and propagating, they also protect, in the sense that they ensure that the parampara goes on, the teachings of the Sampradaya continue. But when we talk of the acharyas protecting the teachings of the sampradaya, we specifically refer to them protecting the purity of the teachings. Because everything in this world very easily gets contaminated and distorted. And in most sampradayas we see that the teachings over a period of time become distorted. The scriptures change, the teachings change, there are speculations that come in at every generation. And many generations down the line, you end up with teachings that may be quite different from what the original teacher actually taught. Many of the other religions today, for example, one can understand there is a disconnect between the original teacher's teachings and the way the teachings are presented today. But the acharya's work is to ensure the fidelity and the purity of those teachings, to see that they don't get changed, they don't get distorted. And this is something in particular that Bhaktivinoda Thakur has done. One of his greatest contributions to our movement is that he has protected our teachings at a time when they were significantly distorted by various kinds of people. It is mentioned that there were four dark ages as far as Gaudiya Vaishnavism is concerned. The first dark age was before Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. There was only Madhavendra Puri and there was Ishwar Puri. But there wasn't so much of propagation of this mood of ecstatic devotion of Vrindavan. And all sorts of things were going on in the name of devotion. Then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came and dispelled that darkness. The second dark period came after the disappearance of the six Goswamis. Even though the acharyas were there, but by and large darkness began to set in so soon. Such is the nature of this material world that soon after the departure of great acharyas who have done exemplary work, extraordinary work, somehow or the other there is distortion and corruption in their teachings by their followers or so-called followers. And then after that, to dispel that darkness, came great personalities like Shyamananda Pandit, Srinivas Acharya, Narottam Das Thakur, Rasikananda Prabhu. And then after them, there was another dark period. That was so one before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, one after the departure of the six Goswamis, the third after the departure of these Acharya, Shyamananda, Narottam, Srinivas, Rasikananda. And then there was one after the departure of disappearance of Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur restored the brightness, so to speak, after the disappearance of these previous acharyas. Balada Vidya Bhushan carried it forward somewhat. But after him, again there was a prolonged spell of darkness. And this spell of darkness was particularly difficult. In this time, there were many, many people who claimed to be followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. They claimed to be Gaudiya Vaishnavas. But they significantly distorted the teachings of Mahaprabhu to such a degree that it ended up being something quite different. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur identified 13 such deviant sects, which he called upper sampradayas. For Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, we hear upper siddhanta dvanta harini, that he destroyed all sorts of upper siddhantas, which means inconclusive or wrongly conclusive teachings. So Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur followed in the footsteps of his father and Shiksha Guru. So So Bhaktivinoda Thakur talked about these upper sampradayas and very vigorously refuted their faulty teachings and re-established once again the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in all their pristine and sublime glory. The upper sampradayas were like, for example, the Aulas, Baulas, or you had the Prakrita Sahajiyas who took Krishna consciousness very cheaply and tried to artificially imitate the devotion of the gopis of Vrindavan or the residents of Vrindavan. You had the Gauranga Nagaris who began to portray Gauranga Mahaprabhu not as a devotee but as Krishna the enjoyer. Nagara implies enjoyer. But Mahaprabhu doesn't come in the mood of the enjoyer. He's coming in the mood of Prakriti. He's coming in the mood of Radharani. So this was a fundamental deviation. Similarly, there were the Jata Gosais who insisted that one could become an acharya or a guru only if one was born in that particular line. Seminal disciplic succession, which Bhaktivinoda Thakur strongly refuted. And then, of course, there were others like Sakhi Bheki and many, many others. So they had caused so much havoc in the firmament of Gaudiya Vaishnavism that to be a Vaishnava in those days was something to be ashamed of. Because people in general developed such a bad image about Vaishnavism that if anybody claimed to be a Vaishnava, he would often be ridiculed or he would be avoided in society. Most of these so-called Gaudiya Vaishnavas engaged in all sorts of immoral activities. They were generally not of good character, not of good conduct. And their philosophy was also very confused and mixed. There was a lot of speculation. So Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur saw this as a formidable obstacle. And it is only because of his sheer genius and untiring efforts that he was able to refute them. These movements had become very powerful in their day and age. And he was able to establish once again Mahaprabhu's teachings. Srila Prabhupada mentions this several times in his lectures and works also, about how it was Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur who actually re-established our parampara. That is the reason I discussed this sampradaya parampara at length. Because it went through this dark phase. And if it wasn't for Bhaktivinoda Thakur, we don't know what would have happened to this sampradaya. Of course, Krishna always ensures that his genuine sampradayas will continue. So it was Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur who took it upon himself to restore the vitality of the sampradaya. He imparted a certain extraordinary devotional energy to it and certain philosophical clarity to the conclusions, and wrote hundreds of books explaining these teachings. And Srila Prabhupada mentions in one place that I don't know what is the connection, but I was born, he says, in the same year that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur launched his preaching mission. Because that was the year, 1896, in which he sent his book, Lord Chaitanya, Life and Precepts. He sent it to McGill University in Canada. And this was probably one of the first times in recent history when the teachings of Gaudiya Vaishnavism were sent beyond the boundaries of India, over the seas. Of course, in the Vedic times, it was a globalized world, in a different way from what we have now, in the sense that the Vedic culture was globally prevalent, devotional service was happening in different countries of the world. Just as an interesting incidental comment, in our PAMHO conferences a couple of years ago, one devotee sent out a very interesting point about one of these Eastern European countries where some academic professor, he translated some of the folk songs, the ancient folk songs of his country, into that particular modern language. And in some of those songs, there was actually mention of gopi, the words gopi, Yashoda, and there was stealing of butter and all these things. In this Eastern European country, it's an ancient folk song. So therefore we can understand that, you know, it was a globalized world in those days too. And Krishna consciousness was everywhere. So, but after that, Krishna consciousness entered this era of darkness where it just was restricted to certain geographical boundaries only. And Bhaktivinod Thakur's move was historic, because he sent out for the first time in recent memory a book on the teachings of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Srila Prabhupada said that one of my devotees, he has recently come and told me that he found this book in the library in McGill University. Prabhupada was very pleased. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote literally hundreds of books and articles and so on and so forth. Prolific output. And Srila Prabhupada comments in one lecture that this was a beauty of his life, of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's life, that despite having such cumbersome duties, quote unquote, as a magistrate in the British government in those days, a very responsible position, he was able to find time and energy to write such books and articles. In fact, it would probably need a whole department in a university to go through all his books and study them in entirety. And Prabhupada goes on there to speak about the lifestyle of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He says that he was such a busy person, such a big responsible officer, plus he was a family man. He had many other religious responsibilities as well. But still he found time beyond his cumbersome duties. And this was the beauty of his life, that he wrote these wonderful books and re-established the sampradaya, the disciplic succession, so that it could now emerge as a bona fide sampradaya. He revitalized and rejuvenated the Gaudiya sampradaya, which was languishing due to the upper sampradayas. And it's interesting, I was going through the book written by Rupa Vilas Prabhu on Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Very nice book, he's done a lot of research. And I didn't have time to go through it, but I was just scanning certain parts of it. And I came across a description, detailed description of his daily schedule, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's daily schedule. So just before I came to the class, I quickly noted it down and I thought I'll read it out to you today, so that it can give us an indication of what his lifestyle was and how astonishing it is that given how he managed to write so many books like this. Let's start from the time he would go to bed. He would go to bed around 7:30 or 8 p.m. and then he'd be up again at 10 p.m. 2 hours sleep. Once he was up, from 10 to 4 in the morning, which is 6 hours, he would write and write and write. He would light his lamp and sit there writing. He would write books in Sanskrit. Sometimes he would write in Bengali. Sometimes he would translate from the Sanskrit to the Bengali. Sometimes from Sanskrit to English. Sometimes original compositions were in English. And then at 4 o'clock, he would rest for half an hour, 4:30. He would rise again and then chant on his beads. He would never show his beads to anyone. Always inside his bag, bead bag. And he would chant till 7 o'clock, completely absorbed in the holy names. He would sit by himself. And later on, of course, since we're now at on his disappearance day anniversary, towards the later part of his life, he spoke about how one should chant. He hasn't mentioned how he would chant in these early days in his Grihastha Leela, but definitely later on he did that, so we presume he might have done the same thing in this stage also. He would lock himself up. He would put a cloth on his head so he couldn't see anything, and then he would chant. Now, generally, for ordinary devotees, that's a dangerous thing to do, because one of the earliest things that's going to happen is we fall asleep. And therefore, paradoxically, we have to tell devotees, don't close your eyes, because if you do, you fall asleep. But actually, the best way to chant is to close your eyes. But the danger is that since we don't have a taste for chanting the holy names, we might fall asleep. So better we are a little inattentive, but at least awake and chanting, and sometimes attentive, rather than being completely inattentive due to sleep. So anyway, he would chant from 4:30 in the morning to 7 o'clock. Then from 7 to 7:30, he would write letters. He was very disciplined. He would reply to every letter promptly. 7:30 to 8:30, he would read various scriptures and books of interest. 8:30 to 9:30, he would meet visitors and guests. If there were no visitors, he would carry on reading till 9:30. And during this time, his son, Lalita Prasad, brother of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, explains that he would pace up and down. And sometimes he would be soliloquizing. Soliloquizing means that he would be talking to himself as if he were talking to himself or talking to some imagined person in front of him. He would present various types of theological and philosophical arguments. He would imagine, you know, a purva paksha or an opponent speaking something, and he would try to respond, or he would articulate his philosophical observations. So he used to be absorbed in this kind of thinking, walking up and down. I remember one devotee, one of our sannyasis, not from the Gaudiya Mutts, he said, many years ago I happened to meet him and ask him how he remembered so many verses. I just asked him, because we had attended one of his classes. We had all gone in a big group and there were many of us there. So we attended. He said, you know, when I was a young man, I went into a school in my village, and then I would lock myself up with the permission of the school teacher. I would lock the room. Schools in those days in Bengal and Orissa were very simple, you know. And there was a blackboard. And then I would write these verses on the blackboard and pace up and down in the room for hours and hours, and occasionally look up to see if I forgot a word, and then I would just be memorizing verses like that. He said, I would do it all day practically sometimes, day after day, day after day. In any case, so Bhaktivinoda Thakur would also walk up and down sometimes doing that. And then at 9:30, he would rest for 15 minutes. So it's not that the power nap is a modern concept. So 15 minutes, and then he would once again bathe, have his breakfast, and at 9:55 on the dot, he always operated with a pocket watch, almost like a stopwatch, I think. And he would leave his house at 9:55 a.m. And his place of work, the court, was very nearby. So he would reach in 5 minutes, promptly at 10, he was in office. From 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock, he would deal with anything from 30 to 50 cases that came up before him. And what took other judges half an hour to understand and think about, he would do in 5 or 10 minutes. And he would again take only 2 minutes to deliver the judgment, to dictate the judgments. And his stenographer would take down and he would go on to the next case. In fact, it's said that many people got so envious of him because he was so brilliant and so penetrating in his intelligence that he could fathom the veracity or otherwise of any statement made by any witness or something very quickly. He could understand and grasp it so quickly and come up with a very clear, correct judgment. Then 1 o'clock he would come back home, refresh himself, take his prasadam, and 2 o'clock he was back at work till 5 o'clock. Then 5 o'clock he would come home and again begin translating books, going on till 7:30. And then, of course, sometimes he would spend time with his family. He would, he had children, he had responsibilities. Then he would take his bath and his evening meal again. And then he would take rest at 8 o'clock. This was his lifestyle. That was how he managed to accomplish writing these hundreds of articles and books and pamphlets and so on. And Srila Prabhupada undoubtedly took inspiration from him because he also followed a similar kind of lifestyle. He'd go to bed, wake up around midnight, translate all night long till 4 o'clock maybe, take a power nap, Mangalarati, chant, and then give class. And that's how Prabhupada's day went. That's how these great acharyas operated. So Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a tireless, indefatigable preacher, relentlessly refuted opposing ideologies and established the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu properly. So we owe the existence of our sampradaya today in this way a great deal to the efforts of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Tomorrow and day after, we'll try to talk about his pastimes, about his life. There are many, many interesting pastimes. But since I had the luxury of a three-episode session, so today I wanted to speak a little more on the historical aspects of the sampradaya in relation to Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So it's 9:30. We'll stop here and we'll continue the session tomorrow and day after. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry if I've been a little dry today, but I thought it was very important to say these things. Hare Krishna. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur ki jai.